Welcome to the podcast, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore fresh, forward-looking perspectives on leadership. Whether you're a seasoned executive or an aspiring leader, join us on a journey to uncover the complexities of modern leadership. Because leadership itself may not change, but the way we think about it is constantly evolving. This is Rethinking Leadership, a podcast by T. Yas Business School, hosted by Executive Professor Rumer Visser.
So today's guest is Jeroen de Vlaender. How do you say that in English?
Well, now with a new commercial from Ice-T that you probably have seen with his sidekick, Jeroen. Now it's easier for people. So I always refer now. So I'm very happy with that advertisement, but it's Jeroen.
Jeroen. And how do you pronounce your last name in English?
De Vlaender.
De Vlaender. Jeroen de Vlaender.
Yes.
Jeroen de Vlaender was educated as an economist and later did an MBA. He spent about 8 years in strategy consulting with Hay Group and Arthur D. Little. And after those 8 years, went off on his own with a small group of peers and started the Performance Factory, which is a boutique consulting firm. And you've been doing that since the late 90s, I understand, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So almost 25 years.
25, yes. 26 years. Congratulations.
Thank you.
In addition, you have done a lot of work for TIAS, the business school where I'm employed. You are in charge of the masterclass on strategy implementation, which you've been doing for what, 10 years now?
Yeah, 10 or 11 years.
Yeah, 10, 11 years. And recently, you're spearheading the brand new masterclass called Artificial Intelligence and Strategic Leadership, which I will ask you about later as well. And also very important to mention is Jeroen is author of a brand new book called Strategy Shortcut, released early this summer, July 2025?
Yeah, I think the English version came out in June and the Dutch version early July.
So it's available in English and in Dutch. And congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
So let's start there. My interest is leadership, and not so much strategy, but obviously there's all kinds of places where those two intersect. I say this though, because I am not particularly, I don't consider myself literate in strategy. But I do understand that there's sort of this split between strategy formulation and strategy implementation. And from my vantage point, it seems that most of the attention is always on figuring out what the strategy is. I'm making an assumption here that in the academic discipline, that's where a lot of the attention, at least historically, was focused. Implementation seems to be much more pedestrian, at least at first glance. Just do it, right? You've got your milestones, you've got your, you know what you need to deliver, go. So my first question is, why is strategy implementation worth writing a book about?
Well, I think you already gave partly the answer, because all the energy and focus has been going to strategy. So most of the books and most of the ideas and the insights have been developed there. Same in the academic world. Mm-hmm. Up until 10 years ago, you could find in every university a masterclass on strategy, but you couldn't find a masterclass on strategy execution. Now, when you look at the data, 40 to 60% of the strategy gets lost during execution. So I found there was a big mismatch between where does the attention go from a leadership perspective versus what is now available on insights and ideas regarding where it really hurts in an organization.
That to me is fascinating. There's a parallel with organizational change efforts, where typically, supposedly, 60 to 70% of these change efforts fail. But in terms of strategy, you would think, you know, given the sort of the existential nature of the questions that it's trying to answer, you know, how do we want to grow? How do we want to, you know, where do we want to be in 2 or 5 or 10 years? It's baffling to me that half, quote unquote, die or wither on the vine in the execution phase. What explains that?
Well, that's one of the key topics I researched. And I found out that besides, let's say, the technical aspects, that you've mentioned in the introduction, like do you have the right KPIs and the follow-up? Mainly, it's related to leadership, and it's related to behavior that is either triggered or not triggered by leadership.
Okay.
And my research shows that there are 7 behaviors that are key and that will make a split between a company that is doing very well in strategy execution and a company that is not doing very well in strategy execution.
And just to be clear, these are behaviors that are supposedly displayed by people at the top, or these are the 7 behaviors that people who are responsible for execution are supposed to be putting on display?
It's both.
Both.
And some of the behaviors are mainly focused on the people at the top.
Yeah.
Others are mainly focused on the people in the organization, and some of the behaviors are displayed by everyone. And I call them the 7 bad guys or bad girls.
Yeah.
So one of the key things leaders need to do is to check, do I know these bad guys or bad girls? So do I have the knowledge and the understanding? And the second one is, do I display them or not? And how are they visible or not in my organization?
So it sounds like you've come up with kind of a roadmap for strategy implementation by looking at it through the lens of these 7 bad guys.
Well, I think roadmap sounds a little bit too technical.
Okay.
So that would be the first part of strategy execution.
Yep.
Basically, when you fly over the field of strategy execution, yep, and you would compare it, for example, with marketing, if you have a course on marketing, people would say, well, one topic is brand marketing, the other is trade marketing, social media marketing. Well, if you fly over strategy execution, one area is the technical aspect, the mm-hmm, engineering aspect.
Yep.
The second one is the people dynamic. So how do we behave as a team? That's where the 7 bad guys and my book fits in.
Uh-huh.
And the third one is you as an individual leader.
Mm-hmm.
How are you equipped to deliver the strategy towards the finish line?
Okay. So obviously I want to go to the team aspect where the book focuses. But since you talked about, you know, what about me as a leader? What is your answer to that question?
Well, what you see is that one thing is knowing,
mm-hmm,
and the second part is doing as a leader. Now, strategy execution is a very interesting topic because I found out that senior people very often don't know what is needed. I give you one example.
Yes, please.
One topic that people, senior people, love to talk about is when strategy is finished, they want to communicate the strategy, which is perfectly logical. But there is a misconception in most heads of leaders, and that is that how to do it, and we call it a roadshow.
Okay.
And the reason behind it is that if you repeat something enough times, then you should be okay. There is even a magical number that goes around in the leadership community. Maybe you know the number.
No, I don't.
It's 7.
7, okay.
If you repeat something 7 times, you should be okay.
Is that why you have 7 bad guys?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that's a coincidence.
Okay.
But repeating doesn't work in communication. Quand je commence maintenant en français et je me répète cette fois, on y est. So 6 more times and we're there.
Yeah.
So a very simple one is how do you communicate this really important strategy? There are already knowledge assumptions that don't work. It's not repetition that will make work. So whenever I talk with a senior leader and I hear the word roadshow, there is an orange light,
yeah,
starting to blink to say, well, there is a, yeah, knowledge component on your end that is missing. So in the masterclass that we run at TIAS at Strategy Execution,
yeah,
we see a lot of senior people that have this, now I understand why it didn't work. So on the individual side, if you're listening as a leader, one of the key questions you should ask yourself is, what do I actually know about strategy execution that is scientifically proven?
Yeah.
And what is more like a myth?
So are you saying that these 7 repetitions, there's no value there at all? Or are you just saying, no, it's useful, it's just not enough?
Well, it's useful only if you know the context.
Okay, say more.
The context is a language. If you look at a language, what is a language? French is nothing more than sounds. But why does it work for some people and it doesn't work for other people? It's because of context. If I say we have to innovate mm-hmm. our business plan in a way that we get competitive advantage in this and this way, if I talk about this in a context of TIAS, for example, the business school, or I do it in the context of Heineken, mm-hmm. it's going to be completely different because the context is different.
Okay.
Whenever you develop a strategy in your mind,
yeah.
the context is clear because you've spent 3 months thinking, looking at all the data. Somebody in your organization doesn't know. And one of the experiments that I describe in my book is the tapping experiment. So there is a professor from America, from the US, and she showed that there is something in our brain that is called the curse of knowledge. And she proved it by, well, I'm the tapper, and I will tap a song on a table, and you have to guess the song together with 20 other people in the room. Whenever she asked the person who made the sound, how much chance is there that people will guess, or she asked the same question to the audience, there was a big difference. Which one do you think scored the highest?
I don't know.
It was the tapper. Because if I tap a song here on the table,
yeah.
I will start singing along. Whether I want it or not, there is a tape going off in my brain, and I'm singing. It's the context that will make my sound understandable for me.
Yeah.
The people in the room just hear tapping. And the difference is quite staggering. She repeated the experiment 120 times,
mm-hmm.
and only 3 songs out of 120 were guessed.
Wow.
But the tappers thought it would be 1 out of 2. So it makes it... And can you imagine a CEO on stage saying, well, we have to do this, and... And the people are just saying, innovation, culture is important, AI, and you hear all those words.
Yeah, and when do we get the drinks?
When do we get the drinks?
Yeah.
So a key thing, if you want to fight against that particular bad guy, is that you need an approach.
So this bad guy being the curse of knowledge?
The curse of knowledge, yeah. So that's one of the 7 bad guys that you need to fight.
And that seems to be almost an argument to do even more roadshow activity. In other words, give them more. Give them the context so that they start to understand what you're trying to convey.
Yeah, but give context is very difficult. Hey? If you ever try to learn another language, it's not when they give you a book that you will speak the language.
Yeah,
the effort needs to be on the person, and they have to go through a dynamic to start figuring out the context. The best way to learn a language is to go through a language bath where a context is created in your own brain.
Yeah.
So we need to do the same thing with strategy. And a leader need to understand that a roadshow is not going to be the answer, but it's about putting people together that do the same activity. And they have to ask themselves, what is now changing for me based on this strategy? So they have to look at the strategy through their context. And if you take a bank, the reflection process for somebody working at a teller is going to be different than somebody who is in private banking or somebody who is working at the IT department in the bank.
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is the old-fashioned roadshow where, you know, show and tell, even when repeated 7 times, is antiquated and ineffective. What you need is workshops where people in smaller groups, engage with the strategy from their own context, their own perspective, in order to, let it really sink in and really get their own context. But that sounds incredibly labor-intensive and onerous.
Well, it only looks that way because every person only needs to participate in one workshop, and a typical workshop takes 90 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So in 90 minutes, I imagine if we would do it at the university, we would invite you as a professor and we would have a chat on, based on where TIAS is going next year or in the next 5 years, what do you think it will mean for your job?
Yeah.
And what is going to change? So it's basically like rewriting the decisions that you have to make.
I'm wondering, though, how that works, because what I think is that the subtext underneath all of this is we're trying to get people to buy in, not just to understand, but to buy into the strategy, right? And if we explain it fully, probably the best thing best result we can get is that they understand it, but that doesn't mean they're going to be bought in. Is that fair?
Well, it's actually a little bit different.
Okay.
If you want to get somebody engaged, whether it's on a strategy or some other topic, you need to hit three body parts. And the first body part you need to hit is the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And the heart needs to get you energized. So the first thing we need to do, and there is a scientific reason behind that, because today you will receive as much information in one day than your ancestors 500 years ago in one year.
Mm.
So the standard setting of everybody now listening, your brain is saying, no, we don't want to have more information. So there is an emotional component, and everybody in advertisement knows that, is we need to find a backdoor, and first of all, we need to communicate an emotion.
Yeah.
So when you start working with a strategy, for example, don't think about a PowerPoint, but think about what is the story that I'm going to use to open up the debate. And
Maybe I can challenge you a little bit on this. And again, with all proper deference.
Sure.
But I don't disagree with what you're saying. I mean, that seems obviously personally perfectly plausible, but it does still seem to be based on a model which some people would argue is itself antiquated, which is strategy gets formulated at the top and then cascaded down into the organization. And I've done work with organizations where they were rolling out the strategy and they ran into problems. So, let me back up. They had said, we're going to do a workshop with our mid-level managers because we recognize that in the past, we sort of threw strategy over the fence and we expected them to pick it up. And they are a critical constituency to buy into the strategy really and not sort of ignore it, which is what's happened in the past. So now what we're going to do is we're going to have a workshop where we have them engage with the strategy. And I had the privilege of facilitating that workshop, and the amount of resistance that was there in the group was stunning to me. People were essentially insulted that they were being presented with something that was created without their input by, in their minds, somebody who didn't understand their particular business. And so the emotional cord, if there was any emotional cord to be struck, it was a very negative one. Here comes something else that was, plopped down on a plate through the corporate channels. What would you say then to, I'm thinking of Patrick Lencioni, who also has I don't know if you know him, he wrote the book. Yeah. Five Dysfunctions of a Team. He has a saying, which I bought into. He says, people need to weigh in to buy in. So what you're saying, I get it. It focuses on the process. Once the strategy has been sort of determined, how do we roll it out? But how much input do you need from those key stakeholders in the initial formulation of that strategy?
Well, I think it's exactly that. We're actually both correct, but we're talking about a different timeline.
Okay.
When you develop a strategy, input is crucial.
Ah.
So I would very much agree with you that workshop that you are referring to,
yeah,
absolute, do it,
yeah,
and get everybody involved,
yeah,
whenever you start a new strategy.
Got it.
Once you've collected all the input, inside and outside, then you make a decision and you say, this is where we go. Think about a soccer trainer.
Yeah.
I imagine you arrive at Ajax, you're going to talk with the players, you're going to listen to the people that come and watch the games, you listen mm-hmm. to the sponsors,
yeah,
and then you say, well, based on what we see here, this is the team, this is how we're going to play. Once that decision is made,
yeah,
you move from strategy to strategy execution.
Got it.
The mistake I very often see is that people don't get that difference. And buy-in needs to happen in the strategy process at the beginning by involving them. But once the strategy is ready, you get into a completely different dynamic.
Yeah.
I've been chairman of a soccer club, and I was always amazed how well team dynamic works there. Because once the trainer said, this is how we're going to play, after everybody gave their input, that was the strategy.
Yeah.
And then the next step became, are you willing to participate within this strategy or not?
Yeah.
And one of the major misconceptions in strategy execution is that leaders, first of all, don't separate those two dynamics. And the result is, if your strategy process takes more than 14 weeks, you're doing something wrong. And what you're probably doing wrong is getting the buy-in after you already made a certain decision, which is a completely different dynamic. The second thing is, what you want to do is answer the right question. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of research on team dynamics, and the key question that people ask is not the one that is in the head of most leaders. Most leaders think, I have to sell my strategy. I need to get buy-in. No. The buy-in is something that you should get.
Happens up front.
The thing you need to answer is, it's not the question, what's in it for me? But the key question is, what can I do to help the team win?
Mm.
It's in a soccer team as well. If you say, well, look, this is how we're going to play with Ajax. The next question is the goalkeeper who's asking, okay, what does this mean for me? Do you want me to run more or not? Hey, if I'm midfield, do you want me to defend more or not? So everybody is reflecting now, how can I contribute? So people are much less selfish than the average leader thinks.
Yeah.
And therefore, the average process that I see in organizations is not set up in the right way. So I 100% agree with your point, and I think it's good we talk about it.
Yeah.
But focus on the buy-in in the beginning and get the input, make a decision. And once you've decided how the team needs to play, get everybody involved and help them to say, well, look, I expect from you as a goalkeeper to do this. I expect from you.
Got it. Okay, so basically what I'm hearing is selling the strategy happens as part of the formulating process. That's where you get the buy-in before the decisions are made. If you find yourself having to sell the strategy once you've made it, you are a couple of steps behind.
Correct.
And then I see a parallel with when I started teaching. One of my mentors said, and it's always stuck with me, never expect students to connect the dots. And that, I thought that was a really nice illustration also of the curse of knowledge. Because, you know, as teachers, we teach a class or a topic many, many times. And the more we teach it, the clearer it becomes in our minds. Therefore, the less effective we are going to be in getting it across to the students. So be sure to look at it from the perspective of the students. Help them connect the dots that to you are totally obvious. And that's what it's coming through for me is you talk about, okay, we've got the buy-in. The question now is, indeed, like you said, not what's in it for me, because then you're still sort of selling it. But the question is, now, help people understand where they contribute. And that's a way of connecting the dots. Did I get that right?
I think we are at 90% based on how I look at it. I think connecting the dots is a very nice example. So I'm 100% a fan of the quote. What is crucial is that when we talk about connecting the dots, what I see very often in practice is that even the senior leaders don't know how the dots connect. A very simple test to figure out how the dots connect is to take the biggest job family that you have in your organization.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to a bank, for example, it's the teller. What are typical decisions a teller has to make on a weekly basis? One, for example, is if there is a queue, how long do we want the queue to become?
Mm-hmm.
Well, an average strategy in a bank focuses on efficiency and client satisfaction. So if I'm a teller, do you want me to cut off the line at 3, call my colleague who is doing cold calling and open up a second teller or not? Which one do I do based on the strategy? So in most strategies are the trade-offs not clarified.
Mm.
So the dots are there. There is a dot innovation. There is a dot sustainability. There is a dot AI. There is a dot quality. But there is no guidance on, okay, if I have to make a decision in my job, and I have quality and I have cost, which one of those two is more important? And the test is identify 10 of those simple questions people in your organization have to make on a regular basis, and do a quick quiz with your leadership team.
So the people at the top who don't know what the dots are, it's not that they don't know what they're talking about in their context, but they don't know what the dots are that the people, let's say on the shop floor, have to connect based on that strategy.
Yeah. Now, thinking it through based on your example, they clearly know what the dots are, but they don't know the priority between the dots. So when you want somebody to engage in a decision, you need to tell them which one is more important.
Got it. Thank you. So that's the first of seven, the curse of knowledge.
Curse of knowledge. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I'm curious about some of the others.
Okay. Well, the second one has to do with delegation. You know, we touched upon it a little bit, and what you very often see with a leader is that he or she thinks the more I delegate, the better I am as a leader. But the problem is that the person on the receiving end, they have or they could have decision paralysis. If you look at your own brain, we have a short-term memory, and it can only hold 5 to 7 things. Mm-hmm. And I'm more on the 5 side than on the 7 side. So it's quite limited. We have a very big warehouse where you can store unlimited stuff, but the short-term memory is very short. It's very limited.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And we often forget that when we delegate. So whenever we have a strategy and we ask, please start working on the strategy, it's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It's too much information and it's too broad. And we think as a leader, we've done a good job because we're involving people. Again, it's the buy-in. But the person on the other side is overwhelmed and they stop moving. So you see a lot of strategy execution efforts fail, not because the strategy is not the right one, but because too much information is dumped on people.
I understand. I'm still flabbergasted by, 50% or so of these strategies essentially, evaporating. That has to have an impact on organizational performance. It has to, right? Or am I naive there?
No, it does.
And how then is that allowed to even exist or continue to? How come that's even tolerated or accepted?
Well, you very often see that there is a very big time lag between people seeing that this is happening and then an action that will follow. Take Intel as an organization. They went through a few CEOs. Now there is a new one and things are moving. So it's not that people don't see it, but it takes a while. When I worked in my soccer role, basically, at the end of each season, you decide, do you stick with the players and do you stick with... And you have a dynamic that the team is on a very regular basis evaluated and move forward. In organizations, we very often drag it out and we say, yeah, just give it one more year and it will be okay. And so the time lag is very often the reason that it takes a while.
Understood. Yeah, makes sense. Okay, thank you. So the first one is curse of knowledge. The second one is delegation or over-delegating.
Yeah. And a nice way to understand that is another professor did a test in, let's say, the Albert Heijn. Mm-hmm. And you have two teams. Mm-hmm. One team gets all the flavors of jam they have. Mm-hmm. In the example here in the US, they did the test, it was 24. The other team only get 4 flavors. Which team sold the most jam? They've done the experiment like 100 times.
Oh, the 4 flavors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why? Because it fits in the short-term memory.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at an organization, I call it dead by KPI. What we do is, because we think we need to share everything, we have those big dashboards, we give all the information to everybody, but it doesn't help. That's why when in soccer, when you train the keeper, all the other players are not there.
Yeah.
It's focused on the keeper and he or she has their specific targets.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is we need to move away from the overall idea we have on delegation, meaning we have to show everything to everybody, is to think about what is now something very specific that's going to help you in your job to be successful. And that's much more difficult.
Yeah.
Because then you need to start thinking about, okay, I have two dots here in your example. This one is a little bit more important than that one. But what does this actually mean for such a teller? And how are we going to count the number of people that are there? Are we going to watch if they get nervous before we react? What is the indicator that we're going to use in order to make a good judgment in order to to have a decision that fits with the strategy?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so this is still on the point of delegating or over-informing.
Over-informing, yes.
What's the next one?
Well, one of my favorites is called mitigated speech. Hmm. And, oh, sorry, it's willpower depletion, mitigated speech we could do later. And it's related to the topic of culture. And I think we all now know that if we have a bunch of leaders in a room, they all would agree culture is important.
Yeah.
But when you start pushing them and ask them, what is culture? And how do you influence it?
Yeah.
It very often gets really quiet in the room. And the reason is because they don't understand the dynamic that is behind the word culture. And that dynamic is called willpower depletion. And it comes from, let's say, performance. We have a new strategy, you have to perform. And we will say, just push a little bit more. That's like the thing we very often say.
Yep.
But it doesn't work like that. And in the UK, they did an experiment. There are two gentlemen, professors called Latham and Locke. Mm-hmm. The listeners probably won't know them, but they're very famous in the community of science. They have developed something we all know. It's called SMART. Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with goals?
Yeah.
So this university decided, let's do a follow-up research. And they got 3,600 volunteers. And their goal was, if you would be a participant, Homer, please pick one goal for 2026. Mm-hmm. Something that you get enthusiastic about, and we are going to track you. Mm-hmm. There was a panic meeting around February 15 at the university because 88% of the people dropped out.
Whoa.
Yeah. So that was amazing. 88%. Now imagine you're part of a famous research, you have people watching you, and still you drop out. And then the university said, well, let's find out what are those 12% of the people doing differently.
Yeah.
And they looked at it, and they found out that they were able to overcome the burden of people stopping. And the way they did it was they turned a decision. And they turned the decision into a habit. And if you look at all the research that's behind it, mm-hmm. if you want to be successful in any domain, mm-hmm. what you need to do is you need to automate decisions.
Yeah.
And automated decisions will make sure you don't stop.
That reminds me of the, I don't remember where this came from, but this parable, if you will, this joke parable of three frogs sitting on a water lily in a pond, and one of the frogs decides to jump in. How many frogs are left? And the answer is three, because you can decide to jump in, but it doesn't mean you'll actually do it.
I really like it.
And it also reminds me of these New Year's resolutions, right? That there are promises or commitments, and in the moment we make them, we feel them fully. Yeah. But if we don't follow that up with creating some muscle routine around a new habit, what you're saying is, yeah, it's not going to fly.
Yeah. I really like that one. And building on that, if we look at those 12% of people that were successful, that touches the core of strategy execution. Still, a lot of leaders think that strategy execution is get people so enthusiastic, get them to buy in,
yeah,
and then they will go to action. And then our job is done.
Yeah.
But that's not how it works. It works. The buy-in part is correct.
Yeah.
But then you get the big team dynamic that we already talked about. But the third step is we need to help the individual to be part of the 12%.
Yeah.
And that's very often forgotten.
Yeah.
Now, how do you get to the 12%? The core of strategy execution is helping people make small choices in line with the big choice. So as a leader, you need to think about strategy execution as a decision dynamic, mm-hmm. not an action dynamic.
Mm.
So when you start thinking about a decision dynamic, you get into the example in the bank. Okay, what are the decisions?
Yeah.
And do we have enough information? And do I feel comfortable to make the decision? But also, a third part, do I have the energy to do so?
Yeah.
And I sometimes work with athletes in sports, and there it's standard. One of the first thing we do is give me your agenda from the last 3 months. We're going to analyze it. And what are the habits or the automated decisions that you have in there or not?
Hmm.
So whenever we look at strategy and we want to be successful, if you want to close the gap of 40 to 60%, you also need to understand the energy system of an individual. And, well, when we are now talking about it, I think most leaders will know habits are important.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the book from James Clear, I think it's the most sold book last year, Atomic Habits.
Yeah.
I think 18 million or so. But 10 years ago, when I started talking about habits, it was a new concept. It has become famous by Charles Duhigg with his book Habits. So now it's getting there. Now, how do we go from here to culture? Well, culture is nothing more than shared automated habits.
Hmm.
Automated decisions, sorry. And it's the quote from Peter Drucker that you probably know.
Yes.
Culture eats strategy for breakfast every morning. And most people know the quote, but I know very few people that are able to explain it to me. Now, how it works is that if you look at culture is shared automated decisions,
mm-hmm.
and they require no willpower. And willpower is the scarce good. We only have very limited.
Yes.
But they're on automatic pilot, so they can keep going.
Kind of like Daniel Kahneman's System 1 and System 2, right?
Yes, exactly. Strategy is new decisions that are not yet automated.
Ah.
So if one team that has unlimited energy is boxing against another one where it's completely new, the winner will always be culture. Now, what I'm always sad is that most leaders know culture is important,
mm-hmm.
but very few take the effort or to get inside the topic and understand, okay, what does this quote actually mean and how can I influence it? So what does it mean for an organization is that when you are developing your strategy, you should not think about what are the actions people need to take, but it's more what are the decisions they need to take and how can we make sure we can set up an energy system around that makes sense.
I'd like to repeat that last question. How do we set up an energy system around that makes sense? Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Let's go back to the teller in a bank. I worked with a bank, and one of the elements in the strategy was the people that work in a branch need to focus more on selling.
Hmm.
And at the other end, the focus was also on be client-oriented. So you had that dynamic. In the end, how did we solve it? By thinking about, okay, what are now the habits that we can put in place that go behind it? And a habit was, we called it the green zone, and everyone in a branch needed to put 1 hour in their agenda where they would be making phone calls to a list of clients that we have identified that had a lot of potential.
Mm-hmm.
So it's figuring out a way between the frogs, should I jump in or not? But be very specific then on going, okay, if you want to go swimming, what are now the next steps? What are the decisions that you need to make? Check the water if it's not too warm or too cold. Make sure you have your bathing suit so that the different steps are there. And once you start jumping in, the first time it will be willpower that will push you.
Mm-hmm.
The second time it will be 2% habit and 98% willpower. And if you keep repeating that, here repetition is the key words, not in communication, you will turn it into something that is automated. And to give you an idea, if you want to drink a glass of water in the morning to be hydrated and start your day, it will take you about 3 weeks of reminders before it is automated. If you want to stop smoking, it takes about 18 months to disconnect. For example, I get into my car and I look for my cigarette.
Mm.
So depending on what you are trying to automate, there is a time lag in between. And it's exactly that time lag that most people are not aware of. And they spend so much time trying to get the buy-in, but they don't focus on the habits. And the suggestion that science backs up is focus much less time on the buy-in. Spend time on it, but make sure, 12 weeks, 14 weeks.
Yeah.
But immediately after that, start helping the people in your team to connect habits with the small decisions so that they lose a limited amount of energy.
Yeah. So you want to sort of create an infrastructure, if you will, where the desired decisions are going to be also the easiest path forward.
Exactly.
Through habits.
Yeah. And we know that from change management.
Yeah.
But you would be surprised how few times I see that happening structurally in an organization.
Understood. Okay. Well, that's a lot under the label of willpower depletion.
Yeah, it's my favorite. So I dived in a little bit.
No, that's great. That's great. And I keep thinking in terms of, the leadership, the leader, whatever, whether it's somebody by, formal position or somebody who just happens to be influential. You've done a lot of work with a lot of companies. And I fully accept, of course, that these seven bad guys, if you take care of them, you're going to be much more likely to succeed in implementing a strategy. And part of me also resists it a little bit in the sense that, it can't be that easy. It can't just be a matter of those seven and then you're fine. And then it doesn't really matter who's at the top or who's calling the shots. They're almost, this probably reflects my own opinion more than anything. There must be something that sets one leader or person apart from another. Do you see that at all in your work?
Sure. And I'm not a leadership expert, so I cannot particularly pinpoint what it exactly is. So compare it with a cyclist. What I tried to do was to identify seven levers that will help you to become a better cyclist.
Yeah.
And those are all related to the person on the bike. But I didn't talk about the bike. I didn't talk about the mental aspect. I didn't talk about... So it is only a fragment, an important fragment, but it's an important dynamic.
Yeah,
I didn't touch about politics in an organization.
Sure.
I didn't talk about charisma. I didn't talk... So leadership is a very complicated and large topic, and I'm humble, and I only maybe touch upon 10% or 15%.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that 10 or 15%, when you look and combine it with the topic of strategy... Becomes maybe 60 or 70%, it's a guess.
Yeah.
Of what if things will be successful or not.
Got it.
I've benchmarked, I think, 2,400 companies. And you clearly can identify that those elements make a difference. Are these the only ones? No.
Yeah.
But specifically related to strategy execution, they play an important role.
And then still, if I ask you to sort of put aside your scientist hat in terms of what's been studied and what the research shows, just your own observations in all the different companies you've worked for, is there any leadership trait or behavior or style that you just subjectively think, that makes a contribution?
Specifically related to strategy or in general?
In general. Strategy implementation, just achieving goals, right? Getting people to commit to and put their best foot forward, right? And kind of like in your soccer example.
Yeah. That's a tough one to pinpoint one topic. First one that comes to mind is curiosity.
Ah.
I see the world evolving very quickly. And when I studied at university, my daughter just graduated from the same university. And if you just look at what they're studying today and what I studied, for some courses, it's completely the same.
Mm-hmm.
But other things have been evolving very much. So senior leaders need to be aware that things are changing a lot. So staying curious and challenge themselves is an important one. I see that a lot with athletes, but they're young. And most of the athletes, their career stops 35, 40. But if you look at leaders, where you will start moving the needles is as from 40 up until 60 or 70.
Yeah.
But what you've studied might have been something from 20 or... So I think curiosity would be one dynamic. And the second one is, but I think it's a very obvious one, it's people dynamics.
Yeah.
I think the older I get, the more I start to realize that in anything that you want to achieve, no matter what topic, that understanding what makes people tick and how they behave and how it influences success, also for yourself, is an important one.
Yeah, and it sounds to me like what you just did with that people dynamics point is actually took curiosity. That the first time you mentioned it was curiosity about what you know and what you don't know, mm-hmm. what's all out there. But then it seemed you extended it to be curious about people.
Yeah,
if you knowing what makes them tick or finding it out requires some curiosity.
Yeah.
And also curiosity about yourself. And there's actually, I will certainly would like to sort of amplify that point because you're being appropriately careful. But I ask you that tough question. But there is a lot of research that backs up the importance of curiosity. Spencer Harrison is somebody who comes to mind. He's a professor at INSEAD. He has a TED Talk about your curiosity as your superpower.
Okay.
And it pays off in all kinds of ways. So I'd really want to amplify that point for the audience. Stay curious. Yeah. That makes a real difference.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a nice bridge to the new masterclass you're teaching about AI and strategic leadership. Of course, everybody is talking, AI is the talk of the town. There's a whole range of prognostications about what the future holds because of AI, from, it's going to kill us all, or it's going to leave us all out of a job. No, it's just a really good assistant, right? And everybody is in on the game. It seems nobody really knows what this thing is going to, where it's going and what it's going to mean for us. So I'm just kind of curious, maybe you can start by high level describing what you're hoping to achieve with this masterclass.
Well, I'm a strategist interested in people. That's mm-hmm. how I ended up with strategy execution. And over the years, every 5 to 7 years, there is a new topic that pops up. I'm thinking about the digital evolution, social media, sustainability, that became more important. And each time as a strategist, you need to think about how do I integrate this into my business?
I'm sorry to jump in real quick, but it just brought me back to 1997, which is, I believe, when I got my first email address. And I was at a conference and there were these questions about, where companies were so used to all correspondence happening by typed, printed letters sent through the mail. And now we all of a sudden have this email phenomenon where delivery is instantaneous. And what does it mean? So anyway, it's bizarre to think about how puzzling that was at the time, but it really was.
Yeah. So AI is now the next topic. And I'm not an expert on AI, but I'm curious. So we started out a journey to see, how is AI now going to influence strategy? And also, how do you now need to react as a leader to this topic? And you see people that embrace it, but very often people push it away because it's more like fear of the unknown.
Mm.
And what we try to do is not to look at the technical aspects. I have no clue exactly how it works, but I know just enough to have a conversation with a scientist or an AI expert to translate it into a strategy perspective so that you, from a conceptual point of view, as a leader, can feel more comfortable in moving forward. And there are still a lot of unknowns, but it's going so fast, so that curiosity here is a really helpful dynamic just to stay on top of the game, how things are evolving. And like I said, when I looked at strategy execution, I've explained there are three ways to look at it.
Yeah.
AI is pretty much the same. And so if you look at AI, you have augmented intelligence. Mm-hmm. So that's the clever assistant that you have next to you. Yeah. And that's basically already out there. The second dynamic is it can be a resource in an organization. So a lot of companies now are looking, how can we now replace? And it's, I think, what was the name of the guys? Champion Hammer, re-engineering the organization. It was at the beginning of my career. So it's business process re-engineering, but with the multiple.
Yeah.
So that's basically, and that's going on in every industry that you look at. Yeah. The third one is it's going to reinvent business models. And that's the really interesting part. There, nobody knows yet where we're going to land and how that's going to develop. And what we do in the masterclass is to give you a foundation to look at each of those three angles and to make you more comfortable in whenever you need to shift in your organization, that you can translate it into your strategy plan and get the buy-in of the people to move forward.
Yeah, and it's where do you? It's a tough question, but what's your sense on at least where it's going in the short term? Do you think it's mostly going to be about when you say business models are going to change? What my inner voice is saying, yeah, that means people are going to be laid off because it means you can do a lot more with fewer resources. Is that what you mean by business models changing?
No, business model changing goes one step beyond. Mm-hmm. So that's not optimizing the current business model, but that's new kinds of companies that will emerge.
Ah, I see.
That will do things differently. What I see in the short term is I like to bring everything back to decisions. So what's going to happen is that in the augmented model, you can make decisions faster. I write blogs, and like everybody now knows, it's a very interesting way to speed up your writing process.
Yeah.
What is going to be the big shift? The big shift is the topic of agents. So when you can outsource a decision to artificial intelligence. And in the first next 6 months, and that's going to be trial and error. And now when you work with ChatGPT, since I think a month and a half, they have the agent module so that you can start playing. But it's very, very premature.
Yeah.
But I suspect that in a year or a year and a half, that's going to be a big change. So as a leader, even if we don't know exactly what's going to happen, having this conversation like we're having right now with your management team and saying, okay, when those agents are coming, what are some of the scenarios that are important for us? That is really important. And I'm always surprised that as a strategist, scenario thinking is like the basic staple of what you do in uncertainty. Because now there is so much uncertainty, people start to freeze and they don't do anything. But that's pretty much, if there is a lion running to you and you freeze, okay, what is going to be your best? I think prepare for combat and make sure at least that you have three or four avenues, scenarios for your organization to say, well, okay, if there are going to be agents becoming more popular, what is this going to mean for the way we deliver our business in segment X, Y, Z, or how to... So it's being curious and prepping your brain to see what is going to be the answer. I don't know. And I think there are very few people in the world that know.
Yeah.
But it's much better to to be prepared and to start thinking about it, then if you today don't have a clue what is an agent and how does it work, well, you're already behind the curve because you won't be able to have a discussion with your peers.
Yeah.
And IT is not going to solve it.
Why do you say that?
Because it goes beyond the process. It will have a direct impact also on the way you do business. And IT can challenge you and help you a little bit, but it's a business challenge, not an IT challenge.
Understood. And so what I think I'm hearing you say is, you know, the uncertainty is a given.
Yeah.
And you can put your head in the sand because you're paralyzed with lack of information or all the options out there. And you can do that at your own peril. I like the image of, you know, if you meet a lion, freezing is probably not the most adaptive response.
Yep.
And putting your head in the sand and waiting for it to blow over is a way of freezing.
Yep.
Engage with it. Start planning scenarios. Get informed.
Yeah. And going back to the lion, there might be lions in this coming over. So instead of waiting until they're there, maybe we should build a tree hut. Maybe we should buy a rifle. Maybe we should get a car. So that's the scenarios. And maybe it will be smaller than you thought, but it's better to be safe than to be sorry.
Yeah.
And it will also create a lot of opportunities. And the companies with whom I've worked so far, by being proactive on this scenario thinking, it gets a lot of energy going. Because you start to feel, well, in control is maybe too much, but at least enough in control to start being proactive on the strategy side.
One of my previous guests brought up the analogy of surfing. You know, leadership as surfing. That is to say, you're sitting there on your board, and you're waiting for the right wave. And then once it comes, of course, you have to learn to identify it. Then you ride that sucker all the way. And then, but you know, the idea that something comes in waves, that's what I'm hearing coming through here as well. This is a wave that's coming, and you can decide not to ride this wave. But look at what's going to happen to all these other companies who do engage and decide to ride that wave.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you can't surf, whether the wave is coming or not, you will be lost anyway. So start playing with smaller waves, do some pilots, play around, dive in, have fun.
Get yourself a little paddleboard, get wet.
Exactly, get wet, go in the water, see what others are doing, build a community, and
stay curious.
Stay curious.
Stay curious.
Yeah.
Jeroen, thank you so very much for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.